Hey everybody, this podcast is a part of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network, and that's supported by Direct West. Is marketing getting in the way of running your business? Things like updating your Google listing, thinking of a headline for a billboard, or making sure your website is in good shape? That's where Direct West comes in. You can get local expert marketing help for your business at directwest.com. Grief. It's a process everyone goes through differently. But the thing with losing a loved one is there is no cookie-cutter approach to getting through it. Artists have a way of coping through the expression of their art. But in 1994, art was the last thing on Dave Grohl's mind. He had sunk deep into a depression and was unsure if he'd ever play music again. He had just lost the lead singer in his band, and more importantly, a best friend, to suicide, Kurt Cobain. Dave was basically just a kid. He didn't know how to recover from his life turning upside down like that. It was too heavy. For months after, Dave couldn't sit down at a drum set. He couldn't even listen to music. It reminded him of Kurt, and it was too painful. But after a long and hard 6 months, that musical voice came calling again like the old friend it was to him. As much as he missed Kurt, Dave realized the one thing he was truly cut out to do in this life was music. And to get over Kurt's death, he couldn't run from that fact any longer. He knew he had to at least try channel his pain into something constructive. Just more than a year after joining this relatively unknown band as their new drummer, Nirvana released Nevermind in September of 1991. It didn't happen all at once, but a few months after its release, Dave would realize he was a part of the biggest band on the planet. The initial pressing of Nevermind was about 35,000 copies, a pretty good indication of the label's expectation to last them a few months. Instead, those copies were gone in a few weeks. And within a month, the record was gold. By Christmas, the record went platinum. By the new year, they were selling 300,000 records a week. But almost as quickly as it happened, everything came crashing down with singer Kurt Cobain's death just a few years later on April 5th, 1994. Davis said, quote, "When Kurt died, I was lost. I was numb. The music I had devoted my life to had now betrayed me. I had no voice. I turned off the radio. I put away my drums. I couldn't bear to hear someone else's voice singing about pain or joy. It just hurt too much." Dave spent the next 6 months away from music. He found himself void of direction and motivation, trying to make sense of a world where Kurt was gone. To continue playing music almost seemed in vain. Dave thought he would always be regarded as that guy from Kurt Cobain's band. He sought solace in the arms of his girlfriend, and just weeks after Kurt's death, decided to marry. They would travel around the world, with Dave being able to reflect on the Nirvana whirlwind that was his life for the previous 4 years. Eventually, though, Dave had to pick himself up and move on, as he'd say years later in an interview. Quote, "There's no textbook to help you through something as tragic and horrific as that. So it was just time to keep playing. I had been in bands a long time before that. I wasn't ready to give up music. And there was times where I really felt like it. It was hard to listen to music because I would just associate it with the death of a good friend." By October of 94, Dave decided that enough was enough and that he needed to get back to the one thing that had always provided him support and security, the simple act of making music. His sense of perspective was brought into sharp focus by words on a postcard sent by the Seattle punk band 7 Year Bitch. They went through something similar, dealing with the death of their guitarist, Stephanie Sargent, in 1992 by a fatal heroin overdose. The words read, quote, "We know what you're going through. The desire to play music is gone for now, but it will return. Don't worry." Dave would later confess that the letter saved his life. Dave has always had an itch for songwriting. In fact, the drums wasn't even his first instrument as a kid. It was a guitar. But when the main songwriter in your band is Kurt Cobain, you kind of stick to the drums. As Dave jokes now, when asked why he didn't write more in Nirvana, what's the last thing the drummer said before he got kicked out of the band? "Hey guys, I got some songs I think we should play." So after many years of recording demos in his basement, Dave decided it would be the perfect time for a creative rebirth, to start the next chapter in his life. Dave's writing contributions had started to grow over the years in Nirvana, and Kurt was actually fond of Dave's songwriting, both lyrically and melody-wise. An example is Marigold, a B-side on the Heart-Shaped Box single from their second album, In Utero. It was the first Nirvana song Dave did all the lyrics and melody front to back. In January of 94, Nirvana had set aside some studio time to work on demos. Kurt wasn't in a good place at the time and missed most of the three-day session, so Dave and Chris Novoselic, their bass player, worked on their own stuff. This is where songs like Big Me, February Stars, Exhausted, and Butterflies were born, all of which would become Foo Fighters songs later on. Little did Chris and Dave know that this would be the final time Nirvana would ever be in a studio. The setting was Robert Lang Studios, in fact, just down the street from Dave's house in Seattle, and it would serve as a perfect place for Dave's creative rebirth later that year in October. Dave decided he'd book 6 days at the studio, just him and a producer slash engineer, to record them. His idea was to record about 15 of his own favorite songs he had written over the years that no one had heard, some dating back to 1990. For each day, he'd follow the same routine. Dave would arrive at around 9 in the morning, along with producer Barrett Jones, who also, by the way, worked on a demo tape Dave made in 1992 called Pocket Watch. They'd start production by noon and finish front to back 4 songs a day. Davis said that throughout the day he'd be running from room to room, still sweating and shaking from playing drums, and then pick up the guitar and put down a track, do the bass, maybe another guitar part, have a sip of coffee, and then go in and do the next song. The only performance by an outsider was one guitar part on Ecstatic by Greg Dooley. Each song was recorded in the same order that became the album's track listing, the first one being the first song Dave wrote after Kurt's death, This Is a Call. Dave deliberately put This Is a Call as the opener to the album. While the verses are intentionally nonsensical to steer away from anyone thinking he was writing about Kurt, the chorus is him saying goodbye to his past with, This is a call to all my past resignations. This is a call to all. Davis said, quote, It's just sort of like a little wave to all the people I ever played music with, people I've been friends with, all my relationships, my family. It's a hello, and in a way, a thank you. Because he wanted the album to stand on its own without any preconceived Nirvana shine, Dave didn't put his name on it, instead hoping people would imagine it as a band. He called it Foo Fighters, the description World War II aircraft pilots would use to describe UFOs. The sound of the record is a continuation of the grunge style that Nirvana was doing, however, with more optimism and more positive energy. It's a sound that has come to define the Foo Fighters over the years. The first Foo Fighters record was eventually released on July 4th, 1995. It was a commercial success, peaking at number 23 on the Billboard Top 200, even being nominated for a Grammy. Looking back, no one would have blamed Dave for quitting music altogether, for those 6 months he associated music with the death of his best friend. But like the true artist he was, he realized he could cope with grief through expression. Music was always there for him, why should now be any different? Dave now woke up every morning with a newfound sense of purpose. His mind was now laser-focused on realizing one solitary goal. In a small sense, making a good record, but more largely, proving himself to the world. Once Dave listened back to the record and saw its quality and potential, his self-perception changed. His heart was inflated with a feeling of being in charge of something, feeling like he had now taken the reins of his life. It was a launching pad for what would become the Foo Fighters. Once the wheels of his creativity started gaining momentum again, there was no limits to where he could now take this. In a recording studio, it was possible to play each of the instruments heard on tape. Live, it was not. If Dave wanted to take the Foo Fighters beyond the realms of recorded music and into the great wide open, he needed a band. And so without fuss or fanfare, he found 3 other guys to join this new pursuit. An extensive tour would bond them together, and 2 years later, it was time for Dave to conduct another experiment. What would a Foo Fighters record sound like with a full lineup? The result? 1997's The Color and the Shape.
The stories behind some of the most famous albums in music history. It's Beyond the Beat with Jared Lennon.
I've made punk rock records, and they're fun and great, and it's quick and there's passion. But I did that with the first record. I've never made a big, proper rock record before, so why not? People just don't seem to do it anymore, so we might as well take a shot. That was a quote from an interview with Dave just before The Color and the Shape would be released in 1997. Having taken on the world and proven himself with his demo tape selling more than 2 million copies, Dave was now in a mindset of pushing his band's sound into more lavish and expansive territories. To realize Dave's goal of making Foo Fighters a band, he had found three other members before it was time to tour to promote the record. Pat Smear was recruited first. Dave knew Pat when he had joined Nirvana in 1993, and of course always looked up to him as a punk rock pioneer in the Los Angeles band The Germs. It was the demise of a Seattle band called Sunny Day Real Estate, where Dave found the future drummer and bass player of the Foo Fighters, William Goldsmith and Nate Mendel. You might ask, why not Chris Novoselic, the bassist in Nirvana? But both Dave and Chris agreed, Nirvana was an open wound they needed to leave alone for a while. Plus, Dave didn't want anyone thinking they were creating a second Nirvana. And so it was an exciting time for Dave. There would be no glamorous tour bus or fancy hotel rooms on this tour. They all piled in a van, and through sheer grit and determination, they formed a bond. For the first time ever, Dave was fronting a full-fledged band, and the creativity started flowing immediately. They perform extensive sound checks where they would experiment with new ideas. Dave might show up one day with a new riff and they'd jam it out and try new things. The ones that were good would turn into a basic song structure, and over time, each member might contribute little parts here and there. It was like the creative floodgates were open. Dave realizing he didn't have to come up with every little guitar part, every drum fill, every bass lick in his songs anymore. That 18th month long tour would finally come to an end, and they knew they had to record a follow-up album. But as great as things were going in this new formed band of his, Dave's personal life was a struggle. In 1994, Dave had rushed into a marriage with a young photographer, Jennifer Youngblood. By 1996, the writing was on the wall that it was a mistake to force the marriage when Dave was going through the tragedy of Kurt's death. He talked about it in Paul Branigan's biography of Dave, the book titled This Is a Call, Dave saying, quote, "We'd been dating for 2 or 3 years, and the day she moved out to Seattle, I asked her to marry me. We were kids, and honestly, we shouldn't have done it. Even in the time we were engaged, I think we both realized that we probably shouldn't get married. And then Kurt died, and our whole world was turned upside down. And so in a way, I think I clung to our engagement and the marriage as like my last piece of stability. It was something to hold on to, and then it was gone too." To top it all off, as he was kicked out of the house, living at a friend's place, he was experiencing these conflicting feelings over finding love in a new woman, as he'd say in an interview, quote, "I was going through a divorce, I was falling in love with someone else. I was living out of my duffel bag on this cat piss stained mattress in my friend's back room with 12 people in the house. It was fucking awful." So as Dave turned his focus onto a possible new album, he couldn't help but write about the pain and conflict running in his head at the time with his marriage failing. In the eventual opening track to The Color and the Shape, Doll, Dave writes the opening lines, "You know, in all the time that we've shared, I've never been so scared." It sets the tone for the record for how Dave is feeling in his relationship with his wife. In the second verse, he writes, "I wish I had never taken this dare. I wasn't quite prepared." Dave later spoke about the song, saying, quote, "It's all about your fear of entering into something you weren't prepared for, which is the way I feel about mostly everything. It can pertain to the band as well, being a singer, songwriter, and freaked out." Doll is the perfect prelude to the second song on the album, the eventual first single, titled Monkey Wrench. In Doll, Dave is unsure of himself and of the relationship. The lyrics set up the uncertainty, the self-doubt, and innocence for Monkey Wrench to immediately tear down with answers, self-assuredness, and self-awareness. The thing with divorce and breakups is that it's easy to just lay the blame on the other person and to get resentful. But Dave tried his best to be stoic about the whole situation and look at the relationship objectively and mature. He opens the first verse taking an overhead look at the relationship, where it's gone, and admitting he's acting childish and becoming resentful with, "What have we done with innocence? It disappeared with time, it never made much sense. Adolescent resident, wasting another night on planning my revenge." In the chorus, Dave then employs the metaphor of him not wanting to be a monkey wrench. A monkey wrench meaning an adjustable wrench, like he's not going to adjust himself to fit what she wants in a husband. Instead of pretending to be something he's not to save the marriage, he recognizes he has to be true to himself, with, "Don't want to be your monkey wrench, one more indecent accident. I'd rather leave than suffer this, I'll never be your monkey wrench." A monkey wrench could also refer to the common phrase of wrecking a situation by throwing a wrench into it. Dave not wanting to sabotage the relationship any further. Dave would later talk about the song, saying, quote, "It's about realizing that you are the source of all the problems in a relationship, and you love the other person so much you want to free them of the problem, which is actually yourself." If the lyrics are downbeat, the music is anything but. Kicking off with a slamming punk pop guitar riff, there's an interesting stop-start before the verse begins. It turns into this great mosh pit banger that translates well into their live performances. One of the highlights of the song is in the bridge. It's the heaviest part, almost like the rest of the track is a build-up towards it. While the rest of the song may be Dave trying on a more mature take of the breakup, the bridge is where he lets all his emotions run through, as if he's speaking to his wife directly in one last argument before they get a divorce, with, "One last thing before I quit, I never wanted any more than I could fit into my head. I still remember every single word you said, and all the shit that somehow came along with it. Still, there's one thing that comforts me, since I was always caged, and now I'm free." In this part, Dave finds his inner deep-sea diver lungs and does it all in one breath. When they were recording, they all sat there for hours trying to get it right until finally Dave was able to deliver the performance. Then he motioned for everyone to keep playing because he didn't want to lose the take. When they play the song live, Dave usually lets the crowd sing this part, or else he has to skip over a bunch of words to inhale. The origins of Monkey Wrench came out of various sound checks while the Foo Fighters were on their first tour. As he'd later say, it was a riff that turned into another riff that turned into another riff. And it's an example of where Dave's headspace was and what he wanted as a whole for his follow-up album. It's why they released it as The Color and the Shape's first single. Rock radio was in the middle of its mid-90s post-grunge morose era, and so Dave wanted to go back to his punk roots a bit, while also telling fans of the previous record they weren't straying too far away from the singles I'll Stick Around and This Is a Call. But as Dave would later say in an interview, he was well aware the first single of this sophomore album needed to be a lot more polished than his previous work, saying, quote, "I knew it had to be good. I knew it had to solidify the band as a legitimate band. It couldn't be just another 6 days in the studio. It couldn't be a basement demo." Monkey Wrench was released about a month before The Color and the Shape on April 28, 1997. The song was a big hit, peaking at number 9 on the Billboard Mainstream Rock Tracks chart and at number 12 on the UK Singles chart. Dave actually directed the video as well. He talked about it in an interview. Quote, "We just started getting all these treatments for the video that didn't seem like they would go with the song. So I sat up one night and just listened to the song over and over and over again, trying to figure some interesting imagery. I went to sleep that night and I had this dream, and the video ended up being the dream I had that night. It's basically the band looking in at the band and how we see ourselves. It's not really like I knew what I was doing. I just really wanted it to seem like a dream." Monkey Wrench is an example of Dave maturing in his songwriting compared to the first record. On his debut, Dave was so worried about journalists and fans overanalyzing every lyric, looking for crumbs about Kurt and the demise of Nirvana, he deliberately write nonsense. A major part of Dave's songwriting growth and evolution can be attributed to the producer of The Color and the Shape, Gil Norton. Gil came on Dave's radar for his work with the Pixies. Dave loved how he could get such clarity out of a band that employed the dirtiest of sounds. The bizarre arrangements on the Pixies' album Trompe Le Monde in particular caught Dave's attention. Gil considers the pre-production time before recording an album as the most important. Once Gil was on board for producing The Color and the Shape, he made it clear that he wasn't going to be satisfied with a bunch of nonsense lyrics. And so he sat with Dave before they even entered his studio, and they went over all the arrangements of the songs. Sometimes Dave would have a great chorus, but no verse. Maybe they needed to change around the song structure. But most importantly, Gil pushed Dave to write about what was in his heart. Gil noticed everything wasn't right in Dave's personal life, and so he was insistent he wrote honest to the core. Dave would later talk about Gil's style of pushing the band to their limits, saying, quote, "He wouldn't let me have dinner until I'd written some lyrics. Every time I wrote a bad line, I'd get 40 lashes. Dave continued, saying, quote, "Man, I don't want to work with anyone else for the rest of my life. He's a fucking whipcracker too, man. He did not like to mess around at all. It was frustrating and it was hard and it was long, but at the end of the day, you listened back to what you had done and you understood why you had to do it 5 million times." Gil not only pushed Dave to write deeper lyrics, but as Dave said, he pushed the band as a whole in their performances. He wasn't afraid of making each member do take after take, hours on end, to get the perfect performance. He accepted nothing but absolute perfection, citing faults with tunings and tempos and intonation and harmonies, to the point Dave, Nate, Pat, and William began to seriously question their own abilities. And he was brutally honest, too. William later said Gil called him and Nate the rhythmless section. Nate said in the back and forth Foo Fighters documentary that Gil worked them real hard, but it was also coupled with their inexperience, saying, quote, "This was my first real recording process. Now there's a producer, like someone who's not just pressing play, but actually saying, I think that should be a C, and you should also play it in time. I could tell when I had to do something a million fucking times and it was taking longer than I wanted to. And it was my first realization like, oh, I'm not a fully formed musician. I gotta keep getting better." Ironically, all four original members of the Foo Fighters came out of previous bands that ended prematurely. They never talked much about their previous bands with each other, especially at the start when Kurt hadn't even been dead for a year yet. But they entered in with this unspoken bond of the band helping them get through the loss of the bands they had been in before. William and Nate both came out of the Seattle band Sunny Day Real Estate. They were breaking up just as Dave was starting the Foo Fighters. Dave went to a live show of theirs knowing it was one of their last and was impressed with the rhythm section. Dave met Nate and William after and left them a cassette of an early version of the first Foo Fighters record, thinking maybe they could jam sometime. Eventually they did at William's parents' house, and as they sat in the kitchen after just one jam, Dave offered them the job. William struggled mentally with performing and playing in front of people and told Dave he didn't think he should take it. Dave said that was exactly the reason he should be the drummer. Somehow that answer convinced William. Before Nate and William, Dave had recruited guitarist Pat Smear. Pat was not only briefly in Nirvana with Dave, but was a punk rock lifer, coming out of the early Hollywood punk scene with his band The Germs in the late 70s. Dave always revered Pat for this reason, calling him one of the baddest motherfuckers in the world. The Germs were rightly labeled as one of LA's most notorious, controversial, and talked about bands up until the suicide of lead singer Darby Crash in 1980. Pat had played in a variety of bands and did a little acting up until he got the call from Kurt to join Nirvana in 1993. Pat was in his own sort of depression since Nirvana ended, mostly sitting in his Los Angeles home smoking cigarettes and channel surfing. When Dave played him his demo cassette, he was blown away. He told Dave he wanted to join the band that same day he'd been given it, which actually surprised Dave. So it wasn't too long after where Pat flew to Seattle and jammed with Dave and his new rhythm section in Nate and William. In the back and forth documentary, Nate looked back on when Dave asked him to be in the band, saying, quote, "I remember it very vividly, Dave saying, let's have it be fun. Let's have things be out in the open. Let's talk about shit. Just no drama." William added, quote, "He was like, I don't want it to be a stressful thing. We're not going to tour into the ground, which I was glad about." Funny how that would actually prove to be false. Anyway, they did end up going on their first tour, opening up for Mike Watt. Mike never actually wanted the Foo Fighters, but he wanted Dave to be the drummer in his band. Dave agreed to perform with Mike as long as the Foo Fighters got the opening slot. It just so happened Mike asked Eddie Vedder the same thing. Eddie's other band, Hovercraft, was also opening for Watt. Not a bad grunge supergroup with elements of Nirvana, Pearl Jam, and the bands Mike came from, the Minutemen and Firehose. Dave opted for getting a van instead of a tour bus. They played 6 shows a week in places with 300 to 600 capacity. Dave later talked about how weird it was to transition from behind the kit to being the frontman, saying, quote, "One of the reasons I wanted to do this was because I'd never done it before, like to stand with a guitar. And I mean, at first I felt like I was in the Chuck E. Cheese band, like how do I move? What do I do? How's my hair?" But over time, you just get used to it. So as the tour went on, they noticed the venues already getting bigger and the hype growing. It was nice, but also weird, because they came to realize a lot of people were just coming to see the former drummer of Nirvana and this new band of his. All the attention kind of weirded Dave out. Nirvana fans would show up and yell out requests for Marigold, the one credited Nirvana song to Dave. And every question, of course, in the subsequent interviews was about Nirvana and Kurt. It was a reflection of that period for Dave and how crazy huge Nirvana got. There was one story reported on in Rolling Stone magazine where Dave walked into a coffee shop and the kid behind the counter said, "Hey, you're Dave Grohl from Nirvana, aren't you?" Dave reluctantly said yes. The kid continued saying, "You know, I was really pissed off when that asshole blew his head off." The kid then paused as if confiding to a friend, saying, "I don't mean to be so frank." It was yet another reminder that since the suicide of Kurt Cobain, virtually every mouth in the free world was spouting off about the loss. Dave adding from that story, quote, "I didn't jump over the counter and beat him to a pulp, which is half of what I would have liked to do. You have to let it bounce off you and figure that it's just some guy you'll never talk to again. Not that many people understand what I'm going through, and I don't expect them to. I don't expect people to be nice or understanding or compassionate because it happens so rarely. I can't imagine what a whirlwind of emotion and thoughts must have been running through Dave's head at the time. Not only was he trying to cope through the death of one of his best friends and the media firestorm that came out of it, but I imagine he was just trying to make sense of the last few years of his young life. In January of 94, before Kurt's death, I had mentioned that Nirvana had tried going into the studio to write and record something. Kurt was messed up at the time and he didn't show up until the third day, so Chris and Dave sat there and decided to work on some of their own stuff to at least try accomplish something while they had the booked studio time. That Nirvana session was where Dave would work out a lot of future Foo Fighters material, and one of those songs that got left off the debut but would be featured on The Color and the Shape years later was a ballad called February Stars. Dave was using that Nirvana studio session without Kurt to just mess around and see what would happen with the tools they had available at the studio. Chris was playing this tabletop organ the studio brought in from Croatia, and it must have inspired Dave as he sat there with an acoustic guitar. Out came this mellow little jam, and eventually with it, these sad and desperate lyrics. Dave has described February Stars as just a song about hanging on by the tips of your fingers and hoping you don't slip and fall. The lyrics weren't fully fleshed out at the time of that recording session, so it's hard to say what was written before or after Kurt's death, but it's hard to look past the reference. The first verse opens with, "I'm hanging on, here until I'm gone, right where I belong, just hanging on. Even though I watched you come and go, how was I to know you'd steal the show?" More broadly, though, it's pretty obvious February Stars is about the common characteristics of the last stages of any relationship. Whether it was his friendship with Kurt or the pending divorce with his wife, Dave could be writing about becoming a spectator of a failing relationship, but still trying to hold on to it for as long as possible. It could also be about developing strong feelings for a girl, a friend of yours, but her not reciprocating it back. In the second verse, it's like Dave is waiting to build up enough courage to tell her how he really feels, but right now he's afraid to ruin the friendship they already have, with, "One day I'll have enough to gamble, I'll wait to hear your final call, bet it all, hanging on here until I'm gone, right where I belong, just hanging on." And maybe Dave wrote about all of the above, the feeling for the girl, the demise of his marriage, and Kurt, all with the common theme of hanging on. Dave likes to keep the public mostly in the dark with the subjects of his songs. The dynamics in the music in February Stars are unique for a Foo Fighters song. It builds slowly, starting off more like a junior high school slow dance song, but it builds to the roaring climax at the end where Dave belts out, "February Stars, floating in the dark, temporary scars, February Stars." The final words represent the bittersweet feelings one can have when they come to a moment of truth. In this case, maybe it's about that their friendship will always be something special, but it will only be a friendship. Now all alone, he's staring at the stars in the blackness of space and comes to terms with his feelings. And if we're trying to draw comparisons to Dave's time in Nirvana, maybe February Stars is a little about holding on for dear life as he was going through that wild ride of stardom. They rose from nobodies to voices of a generation so quickly. It was very much bittersweet for Dave because there was a lot of good times with Chris and Kurt. They shared the perspective of their popularity being so absurd to them, yet with it came immense pressure. Dave later talked about how the bad things that came out of Nirvana are like those temporary scars, and how he can now look back at that time in his life with a smile, saying, quote, "I really thought every time I sat down on the drum stool that it would be the night where I fainted on stage. It was all so hilarious. It wasn't supposed to happen, and it did. One of the saddest things is that it can never happen again, but the greatest thing is that it did." David Eric Grohl was born January 14th, 1969. His mom a teacher, his dad an award-winning journalist, they moved to Springfield, Virginia when he was 3. By the age of 7, his parents divorced, leaving Dave to mostly grow up with his mom. Dave remembers first falling in love with music as a kid, hearing Edgar Winter's instrumental Frankenstein and the classic riff that accompanies it. Guitar was his first instrument, picking it up around the age of 12. He had an old Sears Silvertone with the amp built right into the case, teaching himself with the Beatles songbook he owned after quickly growing bored of lessons. In 1982, when he was 13, him and his family took a trip to see family friends in Evanston, Illinois. And that's where one of the kids in that household introduced him to the world of punk rock. Dave would later talk about that memory, saying, quote, At first, I heard her coming down the stairs, the clanking of chains, the stomping of heavy boots, the sound of a fresh leather jacket creaking like an old ship. And then I saw her, shaved head, bondage pants, torn antipasti t-shirt. She was a fucking superhero, come to life. Something I'd only seen on the TV shows Quincy or Chips. My heart started racing, my eyes widened, my throat clenched. I stood there speechless and in awe. Tracy was my first hero. Tracy would take Dave to his first concert on that trip at a bar across the street from Wrigley Field in Chicago called the Cubby Bear. They went and saw this local punk rock band called Naked Raygun. As Dave would later explain, his life changed that night, saying, quote, "More than the noise and the rebellion and the danger, it was the blissful removal of these bands from any source of conventional popular corporate structure and the underground network that supported the music's independence. That was totally inspiring to me. At 13 years old, I realized I could start my own band. I could write my own song. I could record my own record. I could start my own label. I could release my own record. I could book my own shows. I could write and publish my own fanzine. I could silk screen my own t-shirts. I could do all of this all by myself. There was no right or wrong because it was all mine." From then on, Dave was a punk rocker. In high school, Dave would play guitar in several local bands. Around the age of 15, he was in a band called Freak Baby, when during one practice, he got fed up with the drummer's inability. He never played on anything besides his pillows before, trying to mimic Neil Peart on Rush's 2112 album, but he figured he at least had it down in his head. From then on, Dave became a drummer. And he picked it up fast, so much so that by the time he was 17, he got the opportunity to try out for one of his favorite local DC punk rock bands, Scream. Dave had to lie about his age to the guys, but he got the gig. And that became his life for the next 4 years. Dave saying, quote, "I sort of became more independent early on in life. By the time I was maybe 17 or 18, I had dropped out of high school and started touring with hardcore band Scream, and toured America and toured Europe, and there was no money, and you're sleeping on floors, and you're stealing food, and you're just getting by playing music. Barely." It was a 1990 tour stop in Seattle where a friend of the band, The Melvins, Buzz Osborne, took some of his friends to see Scream. Those guys were named Kurt Cobain and Chris Novoselic. A few months after that show, Scream disbanded mid-tour. Dave called up his friend, Buzz Osborne, to ask for advice on possible next steps. Osborne told him that his friends in a band called Nirvana was looking for a new drummer. Dave knew of them a little bit from Nirvana's debut album Bleach. He got their contact info, flew out to Seattle to audition, and got the gig. For the first few months of Dave's tenure, it's important to remember they weren't very well known. In fact, they were still shopping around looking for a major record label. Finally, they signed with DGC Records, and in the spring of 91, they went to LA to record their next album, Dave's first, Nevermind. With all this going on, Dave is also busy writing his own material, some stuff that would become future Foo Fighters songs. He actually recorded his own demo cassette, calling it Pocket Watch, and using the pseudonym Blate. He was inspired by the drummer of The Police, Stuart Copeland, recording an album under the pseudonym Clark Kent. This punk rock ethos, the style of doing it yourself, really helped propel Dave's career up until Nirvana, and then after with the Foo Fighters. In punk rock, you're always an outsider, so you never assume anything will be handed to you. That work ethic coming up in the punk rock scene of DC, and later honed with Scream, always served Dave well. Part of that punk rock ethos is a cynicism of the mainstream, of looking at the big stars and celebrities of the world and not really identifying. Dave has talked about loving bands like Led Zeppelin and the Rolling Stones as a kid, but those musicians were just so technically proficient, he never thought he could be in a band. He couldn't dream of playing the guitar like Jimmy Page or Keith Richards. When Dave was a kid, he didn't really have those big rock and roll heroes, saying in an interview, quote, "Heroes are a funny thing. When I was young, I had Kiss posters and I listened to Rush and I thought the Beatles were magicians. But the real heroes in my life were people that I was close to. Pete Stahl, who was the singer of Scream, was one. I was 17 years old when we hit the road and that guy showed me the ropes. So to me, he was a hero and family members. My mom's a saint. She raised two kids with no money, and we managed to be a happy family. So she seems like a hero to me." And that's where the third single from The Color and the Shape was born, one of the Foo Fighters' most well-known songs, It's My Hero. The song is a tribute to those everyday people who don't get the recognition they deserve. The sentiment on this track is simple. You don't have to be rich or famous or successful to do something good or heroic. With Dave saying, quote, I didn't want to grow up and be some big sporting hero. My heroes were ordinary people, and the people that I have a lot of respect for are just solid everyday people, people you can rely on. We all have regular people in our family or within our own community who don't get the recognition they deserve, but are courageous nonetheless. It's a strong sign of maturity for being just 26 years old, the age Dave was when he wrote it. The first verse starts with Dave explaining how he came to realize that the conventional heroes portrayed in the media lost its meaning on him as he grew older. Dave is tearing down the photos of his previous heroes and is now left puzzled how obvious it was to him that his former idols are no longer his heroes. With the first verse, too alarming now to talk about. Take your pictures down and shake it out. Truth or consequence, say it aloud. Use that evidence, race it around. And then the chorus comes, which hits home the obvious message of the song. There goes my hero, watch him as he goes. There goes my hero, he's ordinary. Of course, once the first Foo Fighters record came out, everyone peered over the lyrics to find any trace of Dave writing about Kurt. And so inevitably, everyone assumed my hero was about him. Dave has denied it, only admitting that there was definitely an element of Kurt in there. But there are a couple of clues that hint to Dave maybe not telling us the truth, that in fact the song could have stemmed from thinking about Kurt. Forgive me for making any leaps. Of course, correlation doesn't necessarily equal causation. But let's have some fun here. In the second verse, it opens with the lines, don't the best of them bleed it out, while the rest of them peter out. It could be about ordinary heroes being much more courageous, never giving up when encountering struggle, as opposed to the pretenders. It could also be a reference to a Neil Young lyric Kurt referenced in his suicide note, it's better to burn out than fade away. And then in the bridge, Dave writes, kudos, my hero, leaving all the mess, you know my hero, the one that's on. As heard in the demos and early live versions of the song, that last line was originally the one that's on the left. Of course, Kurt being on Dave's left when they would perform on stage. We'll likely never know the true origin, likely an amalgamation of many facets of Dave's life. Bradley Cook, the recording engineer for the song, stated that Dave told him specifically that it was a track about Cobain. What we do know is that it's a reflection of the different, more mature way Dave looked at the world coming out of the death of one of his best friends, saying in an interview, quote, after Kurt died, the whole idea of hero worship or idolatry warped into something I thought was strange. You take a human being and you turn them into a deity. It's really bizarre. I remember I was driving around Ireland when I was trying to get away from that whole fiasco after Kurt died. I was in the middle of nowhere and it was beautiful. But then I was driving down a country road and I saw a hitchhiker with a Kurt Cobain t-shirt on. So my perception of a hero kind of changed. The earliest record of My Hero being played live came well before the Foo Fighters hit the studio to record The Color and the Shape. It was first played live at Vancouver's Commodore Ballroom on July 20th, 1995, 3 days after being written and some 2 years before the release of the album. If you listen back to Dave's Pocket Watch demo cassette, you can hear a similar drum pattern to the famous one in My Hero on the track Pokey My Little Puppy. My Hero was actually the first song that resonated with producer Gil Norton when they first sat together before they went into the studio to run over the song structures. Gil has said that Dave played the riff for him on acoustic guitar and immediately could hear the intention of the song and what the melody was doing, just by the riff and the emotion in it. Gil said in an interview that it's a testament to Dave's unique guitar playing, which he doesn't get a lot of credit for, saying it stems from his drum origins. Gil saying, quote, if you write on guitar, it's about how you play the rhythm. By the time you bring a drummer in, it can change the rhythm and you can lose what the song was. It can get watered down or diminished. It's nice to start off with acoustic and vocal. Dave can get shit for his basic style of playing guitar, but even to this day, he doesn't identify as a guitar player. He's a drummer first and foremost. He said before that when he's playing drums, he's so comfortable he doesn't even have to think about anything. It's purely instinctual, like dancing. Well, when he's singing and playing guitar, he really has to try. But that rhythmic background is part of Dave's guitar charm, and it's how he builds Foo Fighters songs, building the dynamic with a guitar the same way he would with drums. He has said that he looks at a guitar like a drum set. The lower strings are the kick and snares, the higher ones being the cymbals. And so in verses of songs, he likes to play tight on the hi-hat, but when the choruses come, he likes to open it all up with the big cymbals, just like a guitar letting the strings ring out. No one taught him that, and Dave's kind of proud of that fact, saying in an interview, quote, "I like that if I go to IKEA and buy a shitty fucking chair that I need to put together, I don't really want to look at the instructions. I kind of just want to figure it out, because at the end of the day, when I'm sitting there in my shitty IKEA chair, I feel proud that IKEA didn't tell me how to put it together." As an overall musical talent, Dave is very good if you want to define it by his ability to play any rock instrument and sing. But if we're specifically referring to the drums, we shouldn't forget he's one of the best of all time. Punk drumming is not necessarily sophisticated, but requires energy, passion, and a lot of pounding. But there are enough videos of Dave since his Scream days to validate his drumming chops. That cascaded into Nirvana, where he's extremely effective in amplifying all those elements that made Nirvana great while keeping excellent time. Nirvana was forward and simplistic, and Dave stayed true to that, but he also added an explosiveness along with great unique drum fills and patterns. It's an extremely hard balancing act to do when every drummer wants to be the next John Bonham and show off their skills. You can simply tell off the debut album that the Foo Fighters was going to be a band that took full advantage of the drums in a more traditional rock style approach. The drum rolls, the fills, the intense kick beats, and occasional odd time signatures really set them apart from Nirvana. Not to say it was better, as that it is subjective, but it was certainly more intricate. So when Dave asked William to join the band, he had massive shoes to fill. It was all good on the tour, where it was clear William was competent enough to play the songs Dave had already written, but everything came to a head as they convened at Bear Creek Studios in late 1996 to write as a full band for the first time. All four members have described that time as a bad experience. Nothing was really gelling, and they just couldn't get performances onto tape. It's why Gil was calling Nate and William the rhythmless section. So as a planned Christmas break was drawing closer and closer, Dave knew something drastic had to be done. A full month in this studio was basically producing nothing they were satisfied with. Not only was the recording sessions starting to feel like pulling teeth, but while they were at Bear Creek, Dave was served his divorce papers from his wife. It was a weird time, so after conversations with Gil, Dave decided he'd experiment by re-recording the drums to Monkey Wrench once the Christmas break was over. The result, according to Gil, was a take 10 times better than what they had done with William at the helm back at Bear Creek. When you're the main songwriter in the band, you know what's in your head from front to back of what this song should sound like. But as Dave would later say, it doesn't mean he wasn't conflicted doing this over William's head, saying, quote, "When I've written a song, I have kind of a clear idea of where the basic root accents should lie. That's a fancy way of saying I know what the drums should sound like in my head as I'm doing this thing. That's not necessarily fair to say that as a songwriter who's collaborating with other musicians." If Monkey Wrench was sounding so much better, it made sense to Dave then to put some of the other recordings under the microscope too. In the days that followed at Grandmaster Recorder's studio in LA, Pat and Nate were summoned to redo their parts on track after track. They quickly realized that they were remaking the album, and equally obvious was the fact William was left in the dark, still in Seattle. William talked about it in an interview, eventually catching wind of the situation, saying, quote, "I was like, what's going on? Should I book a flight? I should be down there. And then Dave calls me like, don't come down here. I was like, why? He goes, I'm redoing a couple of drum tracks. And I was like, whoa, okay. And I met with Nate and I said, what's going on? Dave redoing a couple of the tracks. He goes, is that what he told you? I said, yeah. He goes, he redid them all. William was understandably pretty pissed off. He gave everything he had when they were recording up in Bear Creek, working 13 hours a day for 3 weeks, but with hindsight being 2020, he knew something wasn't right. Pat would talk about it in an interview, empathizing with William's situation, saying, quote, "You're a drummer for a band where your singer is the greatest rock and roll drummer in the world, looking over your shoulder and waiting for you to do it as good as him. All right, that's just fucked up pressure. Regardless of how good you are or whatever it is, that's just fucked up pressure. And remember that William was a kid. He was really young." William has said that he wasn't totally sure, but he felt like the record company and maybe Gil both pressured Dave into doing it. Regardless, it was a messed up situation. It fractured the band, but Dave didn't kick William out. William would later say, quote, "He still wanted me to be in the band and tour live. I was like, man, there are some people that are hired in session musicians, and that's cool, but that's not why I set out to play music. That's not what I did it for. For me to have that done to you and to continue playing live would have been damaging to my soul. I would have been going against what I believe in. I wanted to create music, not make money. Davis said, quote, "It's a tough thing to talk about because I know William will never forgive me for playing drums on that record. I know it. And I wish things were different, but I felt like this is what I had to do in order to make this album happen." Eventually, William's original drum tracks can still be heard on Doll, Up in Arms, and the verses of My Poor Brain, but the drums on the rest of the album are all Dave's. William would leave the band, leaving the Foos without a drummer for their subsequent tour, but that was still a ways away yet. They still needed to get the album done first. It's hard to argue that Dave handled the situation well, but he was going through his own shit, as I've mentioned. The scars on his divorce were very raw, being served the divorce papers right before the Christmas break in 96. On top of that, he had no access to his own bank account, he was crashing at a friend's place in the meantime, while also conflicted over developing feelings for a new woman. Out of all of that, Dave was still writing the album. Maybe taking the advice of Gills to write more of what's in his heart, out came a self-described emotional sappy song about getting dumped, called Walking After You. Walking After You doesn't twist you like other soft Foo Fighters songs that radically veer to loud and abrasive in a switch. Dave remains achingly soft from start to finish, including the slight touch of the drums and the jingling acoustic guitar. It's pretty, it's beautiful, and it's heartbreaking. It opens with, "Tonight, I'm tangled in my blanket of clouds, dreaming aloud, things just won't do without you, matter of fact." In the outro, he leaves little to the imagination about the song's subject matter with, "Another heart is cracked in two, I'm on your back, I cannot be without you, matter of fact." And the lines in the chorus repeated throughout the song, "If you walk out on me, I'm walking after you." There are two different versions of the song. The first one is the one featured on the album with Dave doing all the instruments. The second one was re-recorded as a single in 1998 for the soundtrack for the X-Files movie, along with a music video. Dave has said it's one of the few Foo Fighters videos he hates because it's cheesy and doesn't have the fun, quirky tone of their other ones. While Dave allowed himself to wallow on Walking After You, he also wrote another much more hopeful song during that Christmas break with Divorce on his mind. He couldn't shake this chord progression they had come up with in between takes of recording Monkey Wrench back at Bear Creek. The song is in a drop D guitar tuning, so they had messed around with his verse while in the studio, but it was kind of left as a jam. Dave thought it sounded too much like a Sonic Youth ripoff of their song Schizophrenia. Nothing really came of it, until Dave was with his own thoughts, living temporarily at his friend's place in his native Virginia over the holidays, when in a proper 45 minutes, out came Everlong. With its ringing, sustained chords and earnestly romantic lyrics, Everlong remains one of the Foo Fighters' most beloved tracks to this day. Davis said, quote, "That song's about a girl that I'd fallen in love with, and it was basically about being connected to someone so much that not only do you love them physically and spiritually, but when you sing along with them, you harmonize perfectly." Everlong threads an almost impossible needle of creating a rock love song that isn't a ballad, but is earnest and sincere, while also still playing guitars really loud. Its verses are weirdly tender, while the chorus, one of the most shout-worthy in all of 90s mainstream rock, could be from an adult contemporary single. It's why Everlong sounds so well acoustically. The lyrics are about falling in love, starting with the first verse. "Hello, I've waited here for you, Everlong. Tonight, I throw myself in two, and out of the red, out of her head, she sang." Into and out of the red may be for Dave what out of her head is for the woman in the song. They both can't help but express truly honest feelings about each other, what they might think in clear-headed moments as crazy. In the second part of the verse, the same sentiment is expressed, as if they know they should take things slow, but they just can't help themselves. "Come down and waste away with me, down with me. Slow, how you wanted it to be. I'm over my head, out of her head," she sang. Given Dave's condition at the time, "come down and waste away with me" may be another way of saying, "join me in my hopeless condition so I don't have to be alone. Take away my pain by giving me real love." The pre-chorus then kicks in, followed by the chorus, where the power of Everlong really shines through. "And I wonder, when I sing along with you, if everything could ever feel this real forever, if anything could ever be this good again, the only thing I'll ever ask of you, you've got to promise not to stop when I say when," she sang. It's about nostalgia, one of the most powerful tools in songwriting. Based on Dave's experience with the first marriage, he knew that the good times would not always roll. It's sad when you think about it, trying to enjoy this new love, but knowing the ifs are just empty wishes. The second verse opens with one of the most memorable lines from the song, "Breathe out so I can breathe you in, hold you in. And now I know you've always been, and out of your head, out of my head I sang." Just as Dave said in the quote about the song, he repeats the lines about him and her singing, because it's about finding such a perfect woman and partner, even singing together matches in perfect harmony. Ironically, Dave is literally singing along with a girl the song is rumored to be about, Louise Post of the band Veruca Salt. She is credited in the liner notes for backing vocals, singing the harmony part with Dave in the chorus, and singing along with a guitar part after the "she sang" lyrics. She's low in the mix because she had to sing the parts over the phone. For the whisper part breakdown, you hear someone softly talking, but it's put through so many filters it's hard to make out what they're actually saying. Dave did three separate spoken word takes for this part. One retells a childhood story from assistant engineer Ryan Bosch of being punished for disturbing his father's sleep. The second is just Dave reading an instruction manual, and the third is a love letter. All three were blended together in the final mix. The wonder of Everlong is that it simultaneously functions as both a song about exciting new love and persisting romantic disillusionment. It's a battle between the two sensations, the new romance ultimately triumphing with the final words, "and I wonder," but also leaving you with doubt. Dave has recounted a story years later when they were opening up for Bob Dylan on a tour, and he got a chance to meet him one night. Dave was understandably quite nervous because Bob doesn't really like to meet or interact with his opening acts very often. As Dave would say, he was told to meet him in some dark, mysterious corner in one of the arenas they were playing in at the time, saying, quote, he said, "Hey, how's it going? Thanks for being on the tour." He was a really nice guy. Then we were talking and talked about his book and stuff, and then he said, "Man, what's that song that you guys got? It says, 'The only thing I ever ask of you, got to promise not to stop when I say when.'" And I said, "Oh yeah, that song is Everlong." He goes, "You got to show that to me. I want to start doing that song." I just thought, you know what? I'm done. Dave has said that the legacy of Everlong really opened up a lot of doors for the band that they probably wouldn't still be around if it didn't exist. Melodically and dynamically, it proved to people the range of the Foo Fighters and Dave's songwriting. The song is both moving and adrenaline-raising, both huge-sounding and incredibly intimate. It's a song that can be played literally whenever. Happy, sad, anxious, nostalgic. When producer Gil Norton first heard it, he remembers thinking that it tied the album whole, the catalyst to bring it all together. It's arguably the band's best and most memorable riff, their best climactic build, and their best music video. David Letterman called it his favorite song ever and asked them to play it for his first show back from heart surgery and also for his final show after 25 years. The video was directed by Michael Gondry, who'd later become famous for doing movies such as Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. The unique video is a surrealistic, satirical mix of Evil Dead meets Inception and was nominated for Best Rock Video at the 1998 MTV Video Music Awards. The video features the drummer that replaced William and the Foo Fighters' current drummer after all these years, Taylor Hawkins. It was released as a single on August 18, 1997. Though it became a decent-sized radio hit in America, it failed to crack the Hot 100. Months after it came out, Dave was a guest on Howard Stern's show, and he played the track on acoustic guitar. It wasn't even a planned performance, but Howard loved it, and he played it countless times on his widely syndicated show. It gave the song a whole new life, and to this day, Dave credits Howard Stern with the song's incredible popularity. Dave says it's rare that a song played live so many times can remain so special in its meaning for him, saying, quote, "When you play a song like that every night, so many people connect with it that that sort of communal energy makes it magical every fucking night. Every time I sing 'If Everything Could Ever Feel This Real Forever' and everyone else is singing it at the same time, that's pretty powerful. It's pretty strong. Even on your worst night, it still feels good." When we hear Dave Grohl's name today, the first thing that might pop into your head might be rock star, or success, or incredible songwriter, or confidence. The reality is, his life had to fall apart in some sense before he could realize all of those traits. As the saying goes, when it seems life is falling apart, it may actually be falling into place. The Color and the Shape has been described by Dave as the therapy album. The band went into the recording process unsure of how they would gel. and the weight of Dave's divorce hung particularly heavily over the album's songs, even though he didn't realize the full extent of it until he and Gil Norton began sorting out the album's running order. Once they finally sequenced the songs, it ran like a therapy session, like one man's quest to make sense of the world crumbling beneath his feet. The opening track, Doll, has Dave whispering, "In all of the time that we've shared, I've never been so scared." It then descends into a noisy rush of Monkey Wrench, a song dealing with the exhilaration of overcoming feelings of entrapment and suffocation, ending with Dave singing, "I was always caged, and now I'm free." From this point on, it's a free fall as Dave tries to take stock of the world around him. He deals with love and obsession in Everlong and Up in Arms, about insecurity and betrayal in Walking After You and February Stars, and about childhood dreams and adult responsibilities in Hey Johnny Park and My Hero. And throughout it, he flirts with rage. But the album closes on a positive note with New Way Home. It's Dave comparing a long drive back to his hometown to the journey of life. That even though it's full of twists and turns and can be terrifying at times, you start to realize you can make it through all of it. The phrase, "I'm not scared," is repeated throughout the chorus. Whatever Dave was scared about when the album started has been resolved along the course of the album. Dave would talk about it, saying, quote, "I go through this whole therapy session and I end up at the last track when I realize that it's okay. I can make my way through all of this and I'm not that freaked out at the end. We were joking for a while when we were thinking about artwork for the album. I thought, why don't we get a picture of a therapist's couch on it? For the rest of my life, when I listen to this record, it will be the fall of 1996 and my journal entries, which is a little strange." Hell, Dave was still grappling with being a lead singer at the time and trying to be comfortable singing. He joked that instead of doubling his vocals in the mix, a common technique singers use in the studio to make them stronger, he quadrupled his vocals. Eventually, the Foo Fighters decided to name the album after an inside joke, something random that had nothing to do with a therapy theme. It was inspired by a bowling pin the band's tour manager purchased at a thrift shop. With every stop on the tour, he'd wander into thrift shops looking to buy the weirdest things he could find. One day, he came into the band's dressing room with a bowling pin, a red one with white stripes. The band all laughed at him, asking why he bought it, and he replied by saying he really liked the color and the shape. The band decided to use the British spelling of colour as tribute to their producer, Gil Norton, who's British. The Foo Fighters' debut was more just a post-grunge amalgamation of Dave just seeing what would happen if he put his mind to fronting a band. The colour and the shape was proof he could get past the sophomore curse. Not without growing pains, of course, but proof they could come together to be a full-fledged rock band. It debuted the Foo Fighters as a group that would be a major presence over the next two decades, and immediately dismissed skepticism over the band as a flighty, overambitious second act for Dave. But maybe more importantly, The Color and the Shape gave us Everlong, one of the best damn rock songs ever made. The Color and the Shape was released on May 20th, 1997. It was a commercial success, peaking at number 10 on the Billboard Top 200, up from 23 for the 1995 self-titled debut. It was nominated for a Grammy Award in 98 for Best Rock Album and remains the Foo Fighters' biggest seller in the US. The Color and the Shape was liberating for Dave. It gave him a new freedom that he could actually write about things he felt strongly about, that meant something to him, and things he wouldn't normally say in everyday conversation. Sure, the Foo Fighters get shit for writing the same three-chord repeatable melodious grunge record every time around that sounds as good in arenas as it does in your local supermarket, but does a rock band have to be something more than dependable to make it top tier? I've heard the guys in AC/DC and the Rolling Stones have had nice careers themselves. Starting with fear and anxiety of moving past Nirvana, of fronting his own band, his vocals, and his divorce, The Color and the Shape guides you through Dave's journey. Not only of this period, but of his whole life. And by the end, he finds that self-assurance and confidence in himself. In the back-and-forth Foo Fighters documentary, Dave had this to say, quote, "It's a crazy feeling when something goes from a spark of imagination to something you can hold in your hands. That first cassette, maybe in 5 fucking days or whatever, and here we are. It's just like, whoa, how the fuck did this happen?" Hey guys, thanks for listening. If you'd like to keep up to date with everything I got going on with this channel, be sure to follow my Instagram page. Also, I do have a YouTube channel where I condense individual stories from my podcast into short video form. So please like and subscribe on there as well.